Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller. Sacred Legions seeks to honor secular saints, whom our patron secular saint Kurt Vonnegut defined as a person who behaves decently in a shockingly indecent society. Today we welcome two workers helping the unhoused in Denver, Colorado, secular saint Alexis Whittem and her saintly sidekick, April Krall. Welcome, Alexis and April.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Max.
So I'll start with you, April, if you just want to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Sure. My name is April Krall. I'm the director of nursing at Colorado Coalition for the Homeless in Denver.
Okay. And Alexis?
I'm Alexis Whittem. I'm the director of communications at the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless.
So, Alexis, I contacted you in the first place because I work with the Charles Bruce Foundation, who has kind of a sidearm of the Homeless Remembrance Blanket Project. And due to a chance meeting we had during the Johnson versus Grants Pass Supreme Court hearing, we went out there for kind of a pop-up event and ran into a journalist, Robert Davis. And he was so excited because we brought a few of the blankets that they do and laid them out in front of the Supreme Court before the hearing. And he said, I would love to connect you with the people who do this annual vigil in Denver for those that passed away in the previous year or whatever. I'll let you explain that because I'm sure you know more about that. But anyway, that is what led to us reaching out to try to do the Homeless Remembrance Blanket Project in Denver, the first time doing it west of the Mississippi. So that's how I got to know you. How did you get involved in working with the unhoused in the first place, Alexis?
Thanks for asking that, Max. I actually would love to start with the vigil itself first, just to provide a little context. Yeah. So the Homeless Persons Memorial Vigil is actually having its 36th year here in Denver. And so I've been in the sector about 4 years and in this position 4 years, but it predates me by so much. This is a real community event on the longest night of the year. And I think that people who maybe don't normally engage with homelessness are really attuned to it in the winter, especially a tough winter like we tend to have in Denver. And it's a way to honor folks at the end of the year who passed away in the previous year, mostly by people who knew them. So while we do have community members who come and just want to understand the hundreds of people who died in the previous year, it is really a memorial service as well, in the way that many people can't, won't have had one maybe due to finances or other reasons. So we really do view it as a somber event, a ceremony, you know, a non-denominational ceremony. We have candles. We have a eulogy that's provided by one of our consumer advisory board members. We have a chorus who sings songs at the beginning and the end just to have that musical element. And so when we had the opportunity to join with the folks doing the blanket project, it seemed like a great way to draw attention to something that's already happening and, you know, does get hundreds of visitors per year, but maybe isn't well known to everyone in community, especially as it's December 21st around the holidays and a lot of people kind of get in their own world and maybe on that longest night of the year aren't thinking about folks external to them or folks who are struggling. And I will try to then roll into the answer about how I came into this. I've worked in the nonprofit sector for, you know, 20 years or so, but I definitely wasn't in direct services organizations in this way or in homelessness or housing sectors. That has been a real shift for me as an individual to learn from my colleagues and from this organization that's been around for 41 years. And I think introducing April as my sidekick like hurt my heart a little, because in the communications world, you know, I view myself and our education and advocacy team often as the sidekicks to the actual staff who are working day in and day out with clients. We're really translating in some ways their work to explain it to the community, explain it to legislators, explain it to donors, explain it to anyone who isn't familiar with the work that my work is to almost translate what we do. And folks, you know, we have about 800 staff. Folks I work with, like April, their work is to really do it. So I appreciate that I will accept the title for this podcast. But in general, I think of myself more as the sidekick to our direct services staff.
Well, and that's the thing, too, with this podcast is we have the secular saint that comes on as a guest, and we have the saintly sidekicks. But I don't think there's anybody that we've had on that isn't promoting this message that we want to promote of there really are good people doing a lot of really good things out there. So, April, I'll ask you the same question. How did you end up becoming involved with the Colorado Coalition? Because it looks like being a nurse, and it looks like you were involved in education for a little while too. What was your path to the Colorado Coalition?
This is like the really great thing about being a nurse is that that is one job title that can lead to 900 different career paths that you can take, which is really fun.
Yeah.
So I started my career as a hospital nurse. I started in the emergency department. I worked in busy inner city hospitals in Chicago and San Francisco in the ER. And then when we moved here to Colorado, I wanted to try the intensive care unit, the ICU. So when we moved to Colorado, I switched over to ICU, and I did that for about 5 or 6 years, including in leadership in that unit, which was through COVID. I didn't start in leadership at that hospital, or COVID started before I was in leadership. I started in leadership in about October of 2020. And then stayed with our ICU through about 2022, which a lot of healthcare people were really struggling by the end of 2022 for what am I doing? What is next? Can I keep doing this? I went through a brief period where I thought, am I even a nurse anymore? I don't know if I can stay in this industry with what I've just been through the past couple of years. And everybody literally in the world has their COVID story for what it was like for them. So I don't pretend that mine was any worse than anyone else's, except that I had a little bit of a career crisis of, am I a nurse anymore? So I started looking for my next adventure, and I thought maybe I'll be a legal consultant. Maybe I'll work for a pharmaceutical company. I looked everywhere, right? This is what you do when you're looking for a job is you scan the internet for what possible things exist. And I stumbled across a posting for a nurse position at CCH. I didn't know that CCH existed, and I didn't know specifically that healthcare for the homeless existed. I didn't know that was a specialty. And as soon as I saw it and read about the organization, I applied as quickly as I could and was very, very fortunate to get that position. And so I've been with CCH now about 3-ish, coming up on 4 years, and really feel like I've kind of found my forever home. I don't know that I will be a hospital nurse again.
It's interesting that both of you kind of came into CCH at approximately the same time too. So have you had a bond because of that, I assume?
I mean, I think what's one of the interesting things is I do these external parts of the job, right? So one of the things I do are presentations and tours. And some of the presentations we give are to medical students or nursing students. And I very vividly remember, I wouldn't have worked very closely with April in a lot of ways prior to this, but we were doing a presentation at a hospital for nurses, and to tell them sort of how can you, in the work that you're already doing in a hospital setting, better serve people experiencing homelessness. So I come in with sort of the little standard presentation and statistics and history and all that. But April and her colleague were really the ones who had the emotional part of the story and the way to connect to people who were doing that job. And I was just incredibly impressed with April and the way that she spoke about her past work. And so when UMax reached out about this idea of a decent person, I felt as if it's really an opportunity to think about people who maybe didn't at age 20 say, I want to serve people experiencing homelessness. We have colleagues who have been here for 20 years and they've been doing it the whole time, some even longer. And some of us aren't like that. And I think that's such an opportunity for people to think, maybe there is a turning point, maybe there is a pivot. And so I was just incredibly impressed with the way that April spoke to the nurses we were speaking to. And I just wanted to sort of hear more from her. And I always kind of want to hear more from her whenever we interact.
You mentioned that both of you have been in this for a reasonably short time and had a life before this. So Alexis, I was looking, you were involved in film, it looked like, out in San Francisco. Can you explain that? Because I found that saintly in itself, that getting those messages out.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are people who graduate from college or 18 or whatever, and they go, oh, I know what I want to do with my life. And then they go do it. I am absolutely not one of those people. And I think it only makes sense when you look backwards because, you know, I was once asked by someone when I was doing a tour, oh, did you come from healthcare or housing? And I said, film festivals. And they were like, what? So it does sound illogical, but I think in retrospect, I can see the through line that makes sense to leading me to this work. I was a writer, I guess. I have a degree in creative writing. And I wrote in college, I wrote film synopses, and then I ended up writing for some film festivals. But as I continued in that sector, I moved more into identity-based festivals rather than general interest festivals, and then furthermore into the sort of grant-based programs within that. So what that means is I was working mostly at LGBTQ film festivals and primarily managing the programs that were not like the big money-making, fancy, splashy RuPaul side of things, but more the side of how do we get LGBTQ films and curriculum to high school students who are in isolated geographic areas? Or how do we put free films online so that someone living internationally in a place that doesn't see themselves reflected can see that now? And so it sounds weird to have worked at film festivals, I think. Really, when I look back, the programs I ended up running were all about underserved populations. And then for a few years after that, right after I moved to Colorado with my wife, I worked at the Latino Community Foundation of Colorado. And that also was a strange fit. I'm not a Latino person, and I was the only white non-Latino person at the org at the time. But once again, it's folks who are being marginalized. It's folks who are being underserved. It's folks who are not getting the same resources or having their stories told as much. And so when I applied at the Coalition for this director of communications position, I think I was able to speak to what I think communicating is about folks who are underserved. Being able to do that, I think, is a skill, but it is funny to say that it started with me writing about movies 20 years ago.
Yeah, the paths life takes. I am interested, though, and April, you can actually speak to this, too, because we were mentioning just how marginalized the unhoused are. I mean, of the marginalized communities, that tends to be somewhat even more marginalized because there's so much dehumanization that goes on with the unhoused communities. There's blame and all of this other craziness that just doesn't really exist. And I wonder if both of you could speak to that, especially in the current climate that we have.
I'll jump in first, if that's okay, April.
Absolutely.
I think first thing to note is that the marginalization is about being unhoused, but it's also actually about all these other demographics who are being marginalized generally. And so you will see disproportionate homelessness among transgender people, around Black and African American folks, around Asian Pacific Islanders, youth, particularly LGBTQ youth, around elders. So a lot of what we're seeing in homelessness is just an exacerbation of the ways in which certain people are marginalized or not given resource in our society. But then I think within it, once someone is unhoused or perceived as unhoused, they do get treated very much like it's an individual choice, and that everyone who's experiencing homelessness, A, looks one way and acts one way. So I think there's a vision, if you ask people right now to pause and think, you know, picture a person experiencing homelessness, what do you picture? Most people are going to think of a single man. They're going to think of him probably living outdoors. They will likely think he has a substance use disorder or a mental health condition. And that's just sort of an outdated idea, and in many ways, an incorrect idea of who's experiencing homelessness. The statistics show us that families experience homelessness. Women experience homelessness at higher rates than they used to. I think people have one idea of homelessness, and that's not what we see in reality. And we also see that there's a connection that is not about individual choices. That if you look at the data, what leads to homelessness are factors in terms of society, structural factors. So for instance, if you look in Colorado, we are the 8th least affordable state. There are only 26 affordable and available units for every 100 people looking who are at that lowest economic level of 30% area median income or less. And so when you are talking about someone who maybe does have a substance use disorder or has some other condition, you have to remember that if you're playing a game of musical chairs that you're already way behind on before you even take account any personal things. So there are 10 people looking, there are two or three chairs. And so if the 7 people who don't get it, somebody is on crutches, they might report to you that the reason they're experiencing homelessness is something about them. And that doesn't mean that that's why they're experiencing homelessness. It's very clear to them that they don't have housing due to the constraints, but they are probably not looking at this data that says that market conditions and the lack of affordable housing are the reasons that people experience homelessness.
And do you have anything to add to that, April?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing I would say there is I feel like that sense of blame, that sense of this is a choice this person has made and a position they've put themselves in, it's really important to look at the things that people who are unsheltered or people who are experiencing homelessness do that they are blamed for, and look at it really transparently as yourself, people you know, people that you're friends with, people that you've heard of. Are all of those people who are sheltered actually doing some of the same things that people who are unsheltered are doing and are being blamed for? So we know that substance use disorder exists in the sheltered population. People who are well-to-do, people who are wealthy, people who have social structure, there's still substance use disorder. And yet it's very easy in a more affluent population to be able to remove the stigma and say, well, it's a disease. It's a thing that we need to treat with rehab and put a lot of money into. But when you translate that to somebody who's unsheltered, it's no longer a disease that they need to be treated for. It's now a personal fault. And there's just a really clear difference in the way that society views those things. Same thing if you think about the need to use the restroom. As a white woman who is well-dressed, I can walk into pretty much any business and say, I know your restroom is only for customers. It's an emergency. Can I please use it? And 9 times out of 10, I'll be told yes, and I'll be escorted to the staff area. That is not true for our clients. They walk in and say, I know I'm not allowed to, but can I? And the answer will be no, right? And so there's nowhere to go. And so I think those differences are really important to highlight. Not that we can solve all of society's problems in a moment, but I think drawing attention to them at least is really important.
I'm glad you bring that up because I understand, I believe Colorado Coalition is one that is in the Housing First initiative. And I know a part of Housing First is you don't worry about the underlying problems that person is going through until you get them into a house. Then provide the services they need to overcome any challenges they might have in their personal lives with whatever it is. We also recently had this change in policy at the federal level that is saying, no, the folks need to be on temporary housing. Get them in, get them out, and get them back into their lives, which is a totally different model and one that I think has been proven to be far less effective. So how is this policy affecting the work that you're doing in Colorado?
I think you're totally right, Max, and thank you for referencing that the data shows that it simply is most effective to do housing first. I think April and I would both argue that it is the most humane option, that it's very hard to go to work and be showered and be present and be well slept and be ready to get down to it if you haven't slept, if you haven't been indoors, if you're cold. That is just a truth about, like, if you want someone to be functional, they need to have safety and they need to not be worried about those things. So I think that we're really starting from the Housing First model we think is moral, but we also think the data shows that it's effective. And you can see that if you're into data, we have a thing called the social impact bond that was independently evaluated and shows that. It's also cheaper to house people than treatment first or other options that work first options. So I think that the argument that I heard when I was on a webinar from the federal government, the new federal government, is they're saying, you know, housing first didn't work. We've been trying it for the last 12 years or so. It didn't work because you can tell because homelessness has gotten worse. And I just think that is what we would call fuzzy math back maybe in 2000, which is, I don't think it's been done to scale. And housing has gotten more expensive. Any housed person listening to this will tell you that housing has gotten more expensive over the last 10, 20, 30 years, and particularly in certain cities and certain states, certainly in Denver. As I said, we're the 8th least affordable state. And so to say that the correlation about an increase in homelessness is about a failure of housing first, I think is either a misunderstanding of data or just frankly disingenuous. Now, that's not to say that there aren't individual people who will report, hey, I needed to go treatment first. I needed to go work first. That's how I was going to get it together. And here at the Coalition, we never discount anyone's personal story that they're going to tell. I'm not going to tell someone experiencing homelessness, don't refer to yourself as homeless. Refer to yourself as a person experiencing homelessness. And I'm not going to tell you that you didn't need work first or treatment first. That can be true for an individual. But writ large, housing first is best. We are, I will say, in terms of how we're addressing these potential changes from HUD and funding, it's all hands on deck. I know the executive team's working on it. I know that the advocacy side of our team is working on it. And I know that we, as a statewide organization, are supported by national orgs who are doing this more broadly, because nothing is happening just in Colorado. It's happening everywhere. And so there's a lot of smart people who are trying to figure out the best ways to address this. And that being said, we're always going to put our clients first. And so we will adjust in the ways we need to be sure that we can maintain housing or grow housing for as many people as we can moving forward, regardless of the circumstances.
And has your organization seen some significant financial challenges because of the shift in what the government did, or did you have?
I would say so far it hasn't had extensive impact because it moves slowly. I guess slowly is a relative term these days. It's moving a lot faster than it used to, but we're very lucky to be a large organization. So as you mentioned, April works in the healthcare side of things. There are 21 community health centers here in Colorado. CHCs, we call them, or federally qualified health centers. The coalition is large and our CHC is part of a larger org. So as stuff gets jumbled, we have a little bit more of an ability to move things around or figure things out in a way that a small CHC might struggle. So we feel like so far the impacts have not been broad, but we certainly are looking at the timelines that are coming out and the potential changes and trying to figure out how to address that for the future.
And since I've got April here, we had previously on this podcast, we had a minister out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who provided dental and health care to the unhoused. But it was kind of like in these pop-up situations. With what you're doing for the Colorado Coalition, is there any difference in that? Or how do the unhoused get health care provided through Colorado Coalition?
Sure. We have a variety of means to connect with people. So just as a brief overview of the services we provide, our kind of flagship clinic, which is in downtown Denver, offers medical, so primary care providers, nursing, pharmacy, dental, and vision. We also offer behavioral health, psychiatry, and case management, all within the same building. And then we have developed over the past many years, we have satellite clinics, one on the east side of Denver, one on the kind of northwest side. And then we have clinics, one that's down about 3.5 hours southeast of Denver at a facility called Fort Lyon, which is a residential supportive services program. It's a 2-year sober living program where folks could go and live for 2 years while they're working through their recovery journey. And then we have a clinic on site there. And then we're opening a fourth facility called Sage Ridge, which is the far, far east side of Denver, kind of out by Aurora, which is a very similar model to Fort Lyon. All of those offer the same level of robust primary care. And then we have an outreach program where we have a big bus, a big RV that has 2 exam rooms, and it goes around the city on a scheduled cadence so people know when and where to expect it, and they can go to the health outreach program big bus to receive medical care. And we have a street medicine program, which is backpack style. So that's a team that goes out and they go to places where they know people are staying that are unsheltered. So the kind of term for folks that are completely unsheltered was coined by Jim O'Connell. I think he coined it. And he's credited with coining it anyway, out of Boston, called rough sleepers, folks that are completely unsheltered. So our street medicine team really focuses on rough sleepers. They walk the streets, they go to doorways, they go to RVs, they go anywhere they can find people, and they'll provide medical care right on the street. So we really try to meet people where they are. If you are in a position where you can come to our Stout Street Health Center, come in, let us get you every service we can. If you're somebody who's not going to leave your tent for the next week and a half, let us come to you. We'll come there and provide your medications, provide your wound care, provide your primary care. So we really try to tailor the work to what the client needs.
One of the more recent things that came up in the news was from Michael Green talking about the poverty line and where the poverty line should be, and the way that, I don't know if this is around the world, but certainly in the United States, we've measured poverty based on food costs. And this guy was like, food costs are not where the poverty line should be, because that's a minimum amount of people's budget. Where the really big parts are with housing and childcare and healthcare, and to even get to the poverty line at the current level, you would need about $140,000 in annual income to be able to do that, which to me is astounding because I've never seen $140,000 a year. So how do you feel about like where that puts people in terms of your work?
I think it's complicated. One of the things that we run into as an issue in our work is when we try to do more housing, we really want it to be create more affordable housing for the poorest people possible, right? For people who need it the most, people experiencing homelessness, people living in true poverty. And we sometimes run into issues actually with people who want to do a sort of middle out approach or filtering. They're like, we want to help. And this is, you know, politics. We want to help firefighters and we want to help teachers and we want to help people at 80% area median income. And so if we help them, it'll all work out. And, you know, what we say is trickle down economics didn't work in the 80s and it doesn't work in housing. Filtering or trickle down housing also doesn't work. So to some extent, I always want to say, let's start with the people who are fully living in poverty and work to solve their problems before we worry about everyone else who's also struggling. I mean, we all know that a lot of people are struggling now compared to 30 years ago. So I think it's important to prioritize people experiencing homelessness and other people living in poverty. And that being said, the solutions are all the same, right? Less than 7% of new construction since 2014 has been for the bottom third of rentals. We had a post-war boom where money went and the government subsidized and helped with building post-war housing, right? I grew up in one of those 1950s suburbs kind of places. And my parents were elementary school teachers and they could afford their house no problem. The people I know now who are elementary school teachers are not affording their housing no problem. But whose fault is that? Why is no one building that housing? The government isn't doing it. And we can't ask people who are living under capitalism to make choices that are not about making the most money. It's not the way that our society has put value, right? And so when less than 7% of what's being built is the right kind of build, and it's a super not enough anyway, regardless of what type, we're going to be in a housing crisis anyway. So here in Denver, we have about 35,000 people experiencing homelessness. We have over 22,000 empty units. They're just luxury units. So we do have housing. It's the wrong kind of housing. So the solutions for whoever we're talking about are more housing that's affordable. There's also Medicare for all. If we all had health insurance, that would solve so many issues, right? Universal basic income, access to food. You're absolutely right that like food is often the third or fourth thing that people are thinking of after, maybe not in that moment when you're hungry, but generally. And so, you know, while I always want to say let's prioritize people experiencing homelessness and not everyone making under $140,000, I think the answers are exactly the same. They're just, we need free healthcare for everyone. We're not even free. We need it to be taken out of our paychecks in a much lower percentage than private insurance. We need more housing that is accessible to people, and we need other ways that folks can meet their basic needs, and that's going to help everyone at every level.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit here because I want to get into the work that you were doing in film, just because I'm interested in that. And it sounded like we had a moment there where both of you had been involved in film to some degree. And I did work with Don Sawyer, was one of our previous guests who did the film Beyond the Bridge, which is also about the unhoused. But if you want to just share a little bit about your work in film, and especially Alexis, with yours being involved with the LGBTQIA community, anything that you can say about the work there, I think would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think working at sort of film festivals is interesting because you're serving a really specific place where you are geographically. So I worked for a long time at Frameline in San Francisco, and you're showing movies to people in the Bay Area. So they're often living like a very free life as an LGBTQ person. You know, it's San Francisco, it's Oakland, it's Berkeley, it's places that people are allowed to be themselves from an LGBTQ perspective. And so it was a great place for me to live and for me to, you know, meet my future wife. And it was awesome. But I really did think that the work we did to spread historic films to folks who are in film school through our distribution or the Youth in Motion program, where it was sending films with curriculum that we got to write to students to talk about more complex issues. We had one set that was a series of four films about transgender and gender expansive youth. You know, those are often the hardest people to support in our community, are youth who are in geographically isolated areas and don't necessarily have people to speak with, right? There's a whole, I don't remember who came up with it, but there's a whole thing about horizontal versus vertical identities, and vertical identities come down to you from your parents. So I am, you know, on my mom's side, Jewish, and on my dad's side, Catholic, and I am white through both my parents, right? But my queerness is not, it's a horizontal identity. It doesn't come from my family. And so when I'm navigating that, I need to learn everything I need to know about who I am and how to navigate the world through peers and not through family. And so, yeah, when we did this program and we sent it to schools, it was great to give, you know, classroom information for that. And I think also, you know, like you talked to Don, film is a way that people learn. Not everyone wants to read our 12-page report about the importance of the Housing First. It's actually 29 pages about affordable housing in Colorado. You know, some people are going to learn so much better watching Don's film. And so I really, as a communications person, just so value how there's all these different ways to learn. And I think a lot of people, especially now more than ever, maybe they're only used to 30-second videos, but people learn. I mean, Gen Z is reporting that they learn their news from TikTok, right? They're not even learning it from an Apple News pop-up. I really think that that knowledge that I have is helpful now as we go to figure out how to explain homelessness to people in this sector, that knowing how films land and what strikes people is really helpful. So it's been great to do it here. And we always want time to do more video content on our social media pages, but it's always hard to get around to it.
I brought this up essentially because I was fascinated by the idea of getting those messages out. Because you're right, film is where we represent people, and people that see themselves represented, it brings them comfort, especially, like you say, in the heartlands where they may not see anybody else that's in their groups or may not know of anybody that's in their group. So I was kind of fascinated by that. I didn't know if you had anything to add from your experience with film, though, April.
No, I mean, I wish that my exposure to the film world were quite as noble as Alexis's. I went straight after college to LA, and I did what you do when you move to LA and try to work in film. I was an assistant at first to a manager for screenwriters. And then I spent some time working at MGM. And then I worked for a producer who had a deal with Warner Brothers and would make primarily Warner Brothers movies. And so the work that I was doing had no social mission at all, but was really fascinating and fun. The thing that's really interesting, though, right, is that all of these skill sets, I went to undergrad for theater, which was mostly, you know, kind of production management. And then those skills are really translatable to being an assistant in any sort of entertainment industry. And then, as remarkable as it sounds, that transition of mine into nursing, all of these same skill sets exist and are the same. I'm time managing, I'm planning. Once we started into COVID, there was a lot of operations and logistics of how are we going to do the thing with the amount of money and the time that we have. Like, that's the same thing as production planning. And then you move those skills into my current role, which is director of nursing, and it's literally the same thing. It's just problem solving. It just depends on what your unique problems are that you're solving. So I feel like my background in film only helped to strengthen the overall abilities, but I didn't have kind of the social awareness that's taken me well into adulthood to get on these topics.
I'm glad that you brought that up too, because you look at this model that we tend to have of American life, and you plan your life at 18 by going to college and choosing your major and all of that nonsense is like, no, none of that really happens. Mm-hmm. And don't get stressed out about it. Well, getting back around to where we started, I didn't mean to take that side trip, but a part of doing this podcast is the curiosity. And I kind of like hearing about that side of your lives. But back into the housing thing with Colorado Coalition, what, other than the nursing and all that, what are the main focuses of what you're doing in the Denver area to help the unhoused?
I'll sort of speak. I think April covered really well our sort of federally qualified health center side of things. So that's covered. For housing, we have 21 properties that are a combination of permanent supportive, income restricted, and transitional housing, but it is primarily permanent supportive housing. So what that means is that you are going to be living in our housing. You're going to be paying 30% of your income, whatever that may be, to rent. You don't have a timeline of when you have to leave. and you have support. So you have case management, and that person is hopefully someone, and most of our properties are able to do this. Sometimes we have limitations, but hopefully someone who is at your building. You can go downstairs to the lobby and find your case manager from 8 to 4, make an appointment with them. And that person you can speak to figure out what wraparound services work for you. I want dental. I want job help. I want to get my GED. I want to reconnect with my family, whatever it may be. So permanent supportive housing, I would say, is most of what we do, or housing with supportive services, or housing first, however you want to call it. Income restricted is just affordable housing. It's just another way to say that. So basically someone who isn't getting those services, but doing does have access to affordable units. And then transitional could be a number of different programs, anything from sites like April said, where we do substance use disorder treatment that are by choice that someone goes there, or other programs that allow that. So housing is a big part of what we do. We have property managers on our team. We have maintenance folks, security officers. So they really are at these different properties, primarily in the Denver metro area. Then we have supportive services. The way I describe our supportive services are, we sort of call it like a Dr. Seuss house. It's not, if you were building an organization from a strategic plan, you would not have the array of services we have. The services we have are because for 40 years, someone says, hey, we really need this. And then we add it on. So it looks like a Dr. Seuss house of services with different additions. We have direct payee services work. We have childcare facility that we run. We have a variety of specialized programs. So that's, we just call that everything else. Like our employment services are in that. And then we have advocacy. I'm very lucky to work on the education and advocacy team. And those team members work at the local, state, and federal level to try to get those upstream solutions. And that's one of the best ways that folks can get involved, is joining our list or coming to lobby day with us. It's just really great to be able, you know, we know that the solutions to homelessness are yes and. They're both. It's April going out and doing wound care on someone in a tent, and it's someone coming in to fix dental care after they haven't had it for 3 years, and it's getting housing, and it's also, can we figure out earlier upstream how to prevent evictions? Can we figure out how to make sure that folks stay housed who are housed, and to prevent further homelessness? So we're doing, all answers are good answers when it comes to solving homelessness.
And we've got the event coming up in December. And I've been involved in some of the Zoom meetings related to that. And I was happy to see that by the Homeless Remembrance Blanket Project coming into this, that you've got that two sides of the coin. One, recognizing the tragedy of the losses that happened in the last year. But then on that other side, the creativity of the people who care enough for the people who are struggling with being unhoused, and providing something that's an artistic display, but at the same time, real help to people that need it immediately. And I thought that that was a good pairing.
Yeah, we're so excited to have this partnership. As April said, we're really well known in the sector here, but if you were someone who wasn't working in the sector, you may not have heard of us, right? April hadn't heard of us before she applied. I had heard of the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, but not necessarily deeply understood the work, having lived in Denver for a few years before applying. And so what can we do to get people who do care and who do live in our area to get involved? And often art, like film, right? Film is a form of art, is one way to do that. And blanket making is certainly artistic for those who do it. And I think artistic for those who see it and enjoy it. So you're getting in people who may not otherwise be engaged with something that's more somber and more direct. Here is an indirect pathway. And also, you know, I run our education series, which is like an online, you know, sort of a lot like this really, but it's just a video series. And we moved it over to our YouTube page at the end. We did one, I want to say in October, that was called How to Be a Good Neighbor, because every time we asked people what they wanted to see more of, they're like, well, what can I do? I'm overwhelmed. The world is falling apart. And I know there's a lot of people experiencing homelessness, and I'm not sure what I can do. And I think that a lot of people want to help and they just don't know where to start. And the Blanket Project is such a lovely entree into one way to help that maybe bring someone in who otherwise might be overwhelmed by the idea of I'm going to volunteer to distribute food, or I'm going to volunteer on site, or I'm going to do some other thing. It's this pathway that you can have that is accessible to people who maybe otherwise wouldn't engage with their neighbors experiencing homelessness. And so we're really glad to have that in Denver this year and be able to have our community interact.
This is one way too, to get the word out about Colorado Coalition, where you're at and your services. How do you normally get the word out? Because you guys have got so much going on to support people that need that support. How do you get that connection to the people that are out there?
I mean, I would say, you know, as someone who works in communications, we are lucky to have been around this long, right? Because our reputation precedes us, and it makes my job as the director of communications simple. I show up to a job with a list of 20 some thousand people who get an email from us every week. That makes my life easier. But I will say that it's how do you reach new people, right? We've been in this in communications for a long time, is that the way that you reached out to someone my age is different than the way other folks are. So we're making TikToks, we're going to in-person events, community events, but it's an interesting organization. We don't advertise our services, right? To clients, they know about us through word of mouth, and they know about us because we serve people, we serve people well. So often what I'm doing in my position is just trying to communicate to community members who don't know us, and it's informing them how to break down these myths and tell them the truth of homelessness and how it isn't about personal choice. It's about structural circumstance, and then how to get involved. Any answer is the right answer. Do you want to advocate? Do you want to learn some things and spread them to your family around the Christmas dinner table? Do you want to go volunteer with us or one of the other amazing organizations in the area that also serve people experiencing homelessness, sometimes in a different way that works, right? Like some of the specialty services that are just for youth or just for seniors are wonderful because those clients feel safer in those places. So go volunteer there. Really, there's just, we don't have any ownership over any of it. It's like anything we can do with our partners, anything that you think might be the right answer probably is. Talk to your neighbor who's experiencing homelessness, ask them what they need, bring them a blanket you're not using from their house, keep coats in your car, keep peanut butter crackers and water bottles and hand warmers in your car if you can afford to do that, and just hand them to people. And if you don't have anything, just say hello and make eye contact. I mean, we hear that all the time from our clients, that what they mostly feel is dehumanized and not seen. And if you don't have any resource, you can still make that person's day better by just acknowledging them and treating them like you would anyone else.
I'm really happy you brought that up too, because you're right. That is one thing that I have heard. And it's so unfortunately easy to just pass by and not interact, because from your standpoint, you're feeling this kind of overwhelming guilt and don't know what to do. But you're right. Just letting someone know that you recognize them and appreciate them for their humanity is a very big thing.
We do a lot of work in this area on the medical side as well. And that outreach to the community is actually to our medical community, trying to create empathy where there may not be any for our clients who end up in ERs and inpatient hospital settings and then subsequently need things like physical therapy or rehab, because those are really challenging for an established healthcare system that relies very heavily on quick turnaround times. It relies really heavily on private insurance. It relies really heavily on reimbursement rates. And when you start to mix our clients into that, there can be a sense of resentment from healthcare staff towards our patients when they arrive at the hospital. And the reason that I know that is because that was me, right? I was an ER nurse for 8 years. And when you, especially as a baby nurse, when you're first starting, you take on the culture of the unit that you're hired into. And so when I was starting and working in Chicago, the treat 'em and street 'em mentality was everything. Like, one of the physicians that I worked with said that if he could install a flashing neon sign in the hallway that said, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, he would, because that's what we needed to do. And so I went through the most part of my career, and several nurses that work with me now are also previous ER nurses. And we all say the same thing. We have to atone for the things that we did that we didn't know any better. So I discharged patients in paper scrubs in Chicago in the winter. I did that, right? I discharged patients with an empty belly who had been in our ER for 10 hours and hadn't eaten anything, but it was time to go. And so I discharged them. You don't know unless someone tells you that this is really damaging what you're doing, and you need to be more thoughtful and you need to be more careful, because you're trained that if you do that, you're doing it right. You're doing your job well. You're clearing the bed for the next person. And I don't fault hospitals for that mentality. I totally get it. This is the system that we're in. But our hope as a nursing team is we go out to schools of nursing. We try to talk to community health classes. And then we've been trying to make inroads with all the local Denver hospitals and try to get into their unit meetings, to try to get into their staff meetings, and give a portion of the presentation that we have kind of in the can and ready to go, that is the question of why are people unsheltered? What is happening here? Because the hope is if we can explain how someone ends up in this position, then when that person ends up in front of that nurse or that physician, that there's a greater sense of empathy and a greater sense of, let me see what I can do before this person goes to make their life even slightly better. It's work that I wish I had had, education I wish I had had as a baby nurse. And so now we try to do it around Denver as much as possible.
Well, the fact that you bring that up, it's just building that sense of empathy is so incredibly important and so easily overlooked. And I think probably just the fact that we have so many things in our society that create that. I mean, I have my challenges with the capitalist models a lot of time, and the healthcare models and the housing models. They're all just so difficult and so dehumanizing that being able to rehumanize some of that is really important, and trying to find the solutions to that.
I'll say that when April and I gave that presentation, I mentioned at the beginning, you know, that is exactly what she spoke to. And it wasn't just her journey. It was also what you can do now. Maybe you are still working with a boss who says, here's a flashing light, you need to go. But I'm sure April has these locked down better than I do. But can you give someone socks? Can you give someone food? I think that ability to give people tools is helpful, because a lot of people will make a good choice if you give them the tools they need.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think one of the things that we talk about a lot once we get in with medical people that's really overlooked in hospital settings is the treatment of withdrawal. The fastest way to get someone to leave your hospital against medical advice is to pretend like they're not withdrawing and to not treat it. So if I always tell the nursing students that I'm working with, figure out what your goal is with this patient. Is your goal to treat the infection that they came in for that's making them sick? And the way that you treat them is with 3 days of antibiotics. If that's your goal, then you need to be aggressive about treating withdrawal while somebody's in the hospital. If your goal is to make this as easy as possible and get them out as fast as possible, just go right ahead and ignore it, because no one will sit in a hospital bed while they're actively withdrawing and being ignored. So that's another component that we really try to stress, is get your addiction medicine team involved in patients if you think there's a chance of withdrawal.
I'll also jump in to use this opportunity to say that people experiencing homelessness do have substance use disorders at a higher rate than housed people, but many of them start using substances while experiencing homelessness, or increase their use, whether that's alcohol to stay warm. One of our physicians has said that he has a number of women who he treats who talked about starting to use methamphetamines to stay awake at night because they were worried about sexual assault. And so, you know, you can't do meth 3-4 times and not get addicted, but you may want to do meth 3-4 times in order to stave off sexual assault. And so these are truths about it that people will say people experiencing homelessness do use substance uses at a higher rate, but that doesn't mean it caused their homelessness or that they were housed and using substances at that level. That means that homelessness is a traumatic experience. It is a physically painful experience. It is an emotionally painful experience. And we all know from the people who use substances in our lives that people use substances to make things easier. So substance use recovery is an important part of our work. And that's why you see it in our model. We have drop-ins at the health center. We have Sage Ridge. We have Fort Lyon. But it doesn't work to force people people. It needs to be low barrier. It needs to be accessible. It needs to be affordable, which means it's essentially free for through us if you qualify, thanks to our partnerships. Like the state of Colorado helps to fund Fort Lyon and Sage Ridge. But forcing someone into treatment doesn't work. And short-term treatment doesn't work. You know, at Fort Lyon, you can stay 3 months to 2 years and you get housing while you're doing it. Temporary housing. You might even have a roommate. Not everyone loves it. You're going to eat, you know, your three meals a day. They might not all be your favorite food, but you can then spend the time you need to work on that. Just wanted to mention the substance use because it does come up so much and we're not going to talk around it like it isn't true, but we're also not going to pretend that that's people's fault when, as April said earlier, it's very correlated to the same way housed people. There's no difference between an unhoused and a housed person. There's no differences in why people use substances. That person is just having a much harder experience.
It's also worth pointing out to Alexis's point, the thing that we always tell people is there is no such thing as clean meth. All of the methamphetamine has fentanyl in it. And so while the intention may be to use methamphetamine in order to stay awake and be safe overnight, what happens so frequently with our patients is they suddenly find themselves addicted to opioids when they don't think they've ever taken them before. But in fact, it was absolutely in that methamphetamine the entire time. I can't tell you the number of patients that I have interacted with who will say, I only use meth. But also I need to talk about opioid treatment because I don't feel good. I'm withdrawing.
I'll also mention we do have a Narcan dispenser outside of the Stout Street Health Center. And many housed people can, depending on the state you live in and the access, have access to Narcan. And it's very easy to use. We have a YouTube video, but you can find them anywhere on how to use it. And so carrying Narcan can be really helpful if you see someone who could be overdosing. To have that just on you in your backpack is incredibly helpful.
Yeah, it was something I learned about from my youngest. They live out in Portland, and they specifically went through training and have Narcan on them all the time to help in case anything happens where they're at. And so one of the things that we talk about on this program a lot, and is specifically tied into the website, is trying to create a resource for volunteerism and self-care. So having those suggestions on just the little things that you can do that may not even require some major organization like the Colorado Coalition or something that you volunteer for, but just what you're doing in your community to help out can be a big thing. Although I will be asking both of you for recommendations for resources to put on the website.
I feel like I've probably mentioned a lot of them, but on our website, coloradocoalition.org, you can go to /community action or /community education. And those will both lead you to learn more or figure out how to take actions for volunteering or joining our advocacy network. And I do think that that recent education series about how to be a good neighbor, you know, we had really different panelists on and a lot of answers were the same. It was like, look, talk to your neighbor, talk to the guy who's living around the corner. Remember that most people who are experiencing homelessness live in the communities where they first were. Somebody who is living on your corner may have been living in the house three doors down a year ago. About a third of the people experiencing homelessness in Colorado this year are newly homeless. So you're talking about neighbors who were housed and are now unhoused. And sometimes with what you think they need isn't what they need, have a conversation about the way to help. And like I said, I try to just keep coats, keep blankets, keep socks, things like that around. And I have given the knit hat off my head to someone who asked me for it. But maybe if I had more of them, I wouldn't have to do that, right? And that can be such a small thing where, like, if you can afford the new $6 hat from wherever you're buying it from, hand the $6 hat to someone when it's a really cold night and you're stopped at a stoplight and you're just looking out thinking, oh, wow, it would be really hard to be outside in this and not be able to get warm. Another thing our outreach team says is like $5 gift cards to McDonald's. It turns out, I think they changed their limit to 10, unfortunately, because I tried to order them online. Something like that is great because someone can go in and not only get their coffee and their burger or whatever, but they can get warm for a couple hours. As April said, I am granted access to third spaces for free as a person who appears to be housed, is white, is female. A lot of people don't have that advantage. And so you gain access to spaces by being able to purchase something. So if you hand them a $5 bill or a gift card, that can help someone to warm up, which in, you know, Denver now, we changed HR policies, the city of Denver, not we, but the city of Denver, that they'll open cold weather shelters at 32 degrees instead of at 10. It used to be 10 and it used to be 20. That is huge for saving people's exposure to frostbite, getting toes cut off, getting limbs cut off because of one tough night. Not all cities have that. In Colorado, go 10 miles outside of Denver and they don't have that, right? So what can you do for folks on those tough nights this time of year?
Well, I think we're coming close to the end of the interview. I do want to thank you both for coming on the episode. I look forward to sharing this with everybody out there. And it's been a real pleasure having both of you here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Max. It's really nice to be given the ability to talk about this all broadly and sort of conversationally. And I spend a lot of time, I apologize to everyone for when I get into my statistics. I spend a lot of time giving a presentation that is like pre-formulated and planned, but I think conversations are always more meaningful. So thank you for asking great questions and wanting to showcase us and what we do.
I was going to say, I really appreciate the opportunity. And I think I'm hopeful that, you know, we hear from some of your listeners at some point. And, you know, if there's any nurses out there, I'll hire you.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler. Original music by Jamie Callan. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.